Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, I said at the top of the hour, we were going to be looking at anniversaries. 15 years since the death of Diana last weekend, and it's the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks next week. So we'll look at some of the reasons both of these events need urgent reassessment and why we can't rely on our mainstream press anymore, really, to do the right thing. Martin, starting with Diana, Sherard Cowper-Coles has been named as the MI6 guy in Paris who was actually organising the Diana assassination back 15 years ago. In this book by John Morgan. Now, Morgan has gone through the Paget inquiry, which was the British inquiry, the French police inquiry into the death of Diana, and through all of the submissions to the inquest, which happened 10 years afterwards, and he's come up with this name, various other names. For example, he believes that she was mistreated in the ambulance by two doctors. The ambulance took an extraordinarily long time to get to the hospital, and also apparently went to the wrong hospital, because there was a much better equipped hospital, much closer to the crash scene. So what do you who is this guy Sherard Cowper-Coles? What do you know about him?
I know that much about him. He was at one stage Britain's proconsul, as it were, in Afghanistan.
He was also, I can tell you, another job he took. I mean, his career absolutely took off, skyrocketed after 1998 for whatever reason. He was also an ambassador to Israel for a while.
Well, yes, he's very much an establishment figure. And, of course, the allegations in the book that you name are things that people ought to pay attention to. Does the British state go around killing people? My answer to that is unequivocally yes.
Well, one of the
people... Did they kill Diana? I don't know.
Well, one of the people who he dedicates the book to is Peter Wright, who wrote Spycatcher. Ironically, another book that was published in Australia originally. I mean, this book, though you can get it here too, the Diana book is called The Paris-London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana. It's about 160 pages long, very accessible, and certainly all fully referenced. There's absolutely loads of references in there. So that's one anniversary to deal with. Next week, we've got the anniversary of September 11th attacks 11 years ago. Tell us a bit about Reinvestigate 9/11.
Well, I'm one of the founders of Reinvestigate 9/11, which is a British-based organisation campaigning for a full independent inquiry into what happened on the day. We've been around for a few years now. We organise conferences in London. If you go to the web, you'll find some video of our conferences. And we work with colleagues in other countries to raise questions about what happened. And there's a mountain of evidence to suggest that this was not what it seems.
Well, I spoke to one of your colleagues who runs the website for Reinvestigate 9/11 about why it is that we should be looking back at 9/11 after all this time. Surely, you know, we know exactly what happened, don't we? So anyway, I had a chat to her a couple of weeks ago.
My name is Fran Anderson. I'm a member of the Reinvestigate 911 campaign group. We're campaigning, along with many people around the world, for a truly proper, independent, scientific investigation into the 9/11 attacks.
Now, who founded the campaign in Britain?
Annie Matchon, who's ex-MI5 whistleblower, who wrote a book, and also Ian Henshaw, book author of 9/11 Revealed. Recently, June the 20th, 2012, this year, new CIA documents were released, and it shows that Bush ignored 7 senior CIA intelligence briefs that warned about the 9/11 attacks, including details of the exact targets and the correct time frame. And there seems to be a blame game going on here, because also ex-FBI special agent on terrorism Ali Soufan, who wrote a book called Black Banners, Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, claims that the CIA wasn't willing to share vital information with him, and if they had, he could have stopped the 9/11 attacks. The CIA finally gave him a file, actually on the day of September 11th, with the information in it that could have prevented the attacks. So the CIA are blaming the Bush administration, and the FBI are blaming the CIA. But Ali Soufan is also backed up by Richard Clark, ex-White House terror czar. Around September 2011, he accused the CIA of deliberately suppressing information before the 9/11 attacks. And, quote, high-level decisions in the CIA were ordering people not to share information, end of quote. That's Richard Clarke, who was interviewed by the same people who produced 9/11 Press for Truth DVD. Also, if we go back a little bit, John O'Neill was the FBI's top expert on terrorism, and he was forced to resign in summer 2001 because he kept warning about imminent attacks.
Now, he was actually very high up, wasn't he? He was the deputy director of the FBI.
So he resigned in disgust, and then he got a job as head of security for the World Trade Center and unfortunately died in the attacks that he was specifically trying to warn against. Apart from this, we also have a number of FBI whistleblowers complaining about being consistently blocked by the CIA prior to 9/11. And we also have a long list of experts now. They are featured on a DVD that's not long out called Explosive Evidence, 9/11 Experts Speak Out. And this contains people such as architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, military officers, pilots, intelligence officers, scholars for 9/11 Truth, a whole host of scientists coming out and saying why they are questioning the 9/11 official account, and with very detailed rational arguments. And I recommend that DVD. Something that people may not be aware of is that immediately after the 9/11 attacks, when planes had been downed and no planes were allowed to fly, the only plane allowed to fly out of America was the family of the chief suspect, Bin Laden himself. So how come his family were allowed to fly out and nobody else was? And yet he was the chief suspect. You'd think that they should have been rounded up, arrested, questioned about Osama bin Laden if he's the chief suspect. But there's hardly been any mention in the mainstream media about that issue. When you dig a little bit deeper, then you find that the Bush family and the bin Laden family have had many business dealings for quite some time. We're living in a post 9/11 world, and in the words of Gore Vidal, we're in a situation of perpetual war, perpetual peace, and his book has got scant mention. And we're having our civil liberties clamped down, more and more snooping done on our activities, and constant war, all because of 9/11. So that's why we're calling for another investigation. And if people think the Department of Homeland Security is fixing the so-called incompetencies of the CIA and FBI for not joining up their information, then you've got another thing coming. The Department of Homeland Security being overly intrusive and putting anti-war activists, 9/11 skeptics, environmentalists, a whole list of people on terror suspect lists in the US.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good reason to actually do a proper investigation into the 9/11 attacks, Martin. Can you give us an idea of how far you're getting with actually getting a proper investigation? Because in the old days, it used to be the job of people like Panorama and World in Action and This Week and these kind of investigative documentaries. They would focus in on something like this, and they'd give us all a balanced idea, wouldn't they, of what had actually happened?
Not necessarily. If you think about Gladio, Tony, the only coverage of Gladio on British TV was Frankovich's three films for BBC Two, which were done in the Time Watch strand.
You've just made my point for me. At least, I mean, there was some coverage on television back sort of 20 years ago for these sorts of things.
You've got to understand that this is psychological warfare. So what you do is you carry out the attack, and then you fill people's heads with what they're supposed to think about it. And there's not been any proper investigation by senior journalists into any of this, apart from in foreign countries. And of course, with the web now, we're very well aware of all sorts of things going on which we weren't aware of in a previous generation. So if people are interested in the evidence, they should go to the Reinvestigate 9/11 website, because it's all very, very carefully vetted. There's no speculation on that website. It's all factual material, and it's all related to the attacks and the cover-up that followed.
I mean, one of the people who, right from the very start, was investigating what happened on 9/11 was looking at the military Elite software, which was being used by NORAD, and that's the North American Air Defense Department, who were actually in charge of defending the United States. And one of the things that they found out was that a lot of the operating systems that this software was running on had kind of access points in. And Chris Bolin pointed out that when you're buying the software, you could also be buying a vulnerability, say, for example, from another country, to actually get access into your air defense systems by a backdoor, by a software backdoor.
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the sorts of evidence that have been covered. I mean, Chris Bolin is very interesting because he goes into a lot of detail about who he thinks did it and how it was done. But Alan Sabrowski is a very interesting character. He blogs on in Veterans Today, which is a US publication. He's an ex-US military guy. He used to be a lieutenant colonel in the Marines. He used to head up the US Army War College. And as he pointed out in his recent stuff on Veterans Today, one of the problems with why the 9/11 movement hasn't got proper traction is because people at an early stage of questioning are overfaced with too much information. Basically, the sort of level of information about, you know, software being infiltrated and so on, that's really for professional journalists and intelligence officers. What I ask people listening to this program is just ask themselves two simple questions. This is what Sabrowski does. Do people know that a third building collapsed on the day, WTC-7? Well, it did, and no plane crashed into it. So the story about how planes caused fires which caused the buildings to collapse can't be true for the third building. It's not true for the other two buildings either, but it can't be true for the third building. All you've got to do is do a computer search, WTC-7, and you'll see the video of it coming down into its own footprint at freefall speed, even though a plane hadn't hit it. The second question people need to ask themselves, where was the United States Air Force for an hour and a half on September the 11th? In the 1940s, after an alert, it took the British RAF maybe 2 or 3 minutes to get airborne. For an hour and a half, planes are flying not directly to the targets, but around and around inside US airspace, and not one of them is intercepted. Why? And all these years later, 11 years later, after an inquiry, we should be able to know. Heads should have rolled. Where was the Air Force? We know where the Air Force was. In actual fact, it was stood down. Who stood it down? Well, you'll have to go to the Reinvestigate 9/11 website if you want to find those kind of things out. People shouldn't overface themselves with too much investigation of the detail. Just stick to the big picture. It's pretty clearly an inside job. And that's what General Ivashov, who is the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, says. Go to his website.
Yeah, this is another point, isn't it? It's actually different parts of the world have different perceptions of the same event now because they're spoken to by different TV networks.
Absolutely. But if people just take one step back and clear their minds a little, the Western intelligence services have a track record of engaging in false flag terrorism. Look up Bologna bomb, Gladio. This, therefore, 9/11 doesn't come out of the blue. It's part of an established pattern of behaviour by the Western intelligence services. And that is well understood by the Russian general staff. And it's a fact that people need to get on board. The Russian general staff are pretty much convinced that it was an inside job. Now, that means whether it was or it wasn't, they are making their deployments accordingly, which is why Putin is taking such a hard line with the West, because he thinks they're gangsters and criminals. He's right, but then so is he.
Finally, then, this book, the latest book out by Chris Bolin, is called Solving 9/11. He has chapters in there, for example, about the destruction of the evidence and making sense of the 9/11 cover-up, the sort of stuff you were talking about there, Martin.
Yes, but I mean, don't overface yourself. Go and look at some of the more straightforward material first. Chris Bolin is a very, very serious investigative reporter, and it's very, very detailed stuff. What some people don't like is he points the finger very squarely at the Israelis, as do the Russian general staff. And Sabrowski, incidentally, as well as being a top US military guy, retired now, is also a Jew. He's quite clear that it was the Israelis who were the main culprits.
But what might be the motive if it was the Israelis?
Because it started the wars which Israel wanted. Israel is saying every day they want a war with Iran. And they were wanting a war with Iran 15 years ago, except nobody was listening then, before these nasty things happened. Now, we could go into lots of details, and on this programme we have gone into a lot of detail about the questions that have to be asked about 9/11. But I ask people to keep it simple. Why did the third building collapse? Where was the Air Force? And once you've answered those questions, which are unanswerable, you can look at more of the complex detail. It looks like a CIA Israeli operation.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, on a related topic is Syria. Citizen journalist Gary Sullivan is going to be in Bristol next week doing a talk all about Syria. And he's actually been to Syria, one of the few of us who's not got all of his information from places like the BBC and CNN. Hi, Gary, I hope you're there and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gary, can you just give us a bit about your background and how long you've actually been in Syria? When have you been there?
Yeah, I've actually been four times in the last 5 years. I went 2 years before any of this crisis really happened. And, you know, and it's a great country. It's a really peaceful, kind, loving country. It's very European, certainly on the west coast. Not many people realize that it's actually on the Mediterranean Sea. So it's got very kind of European feel about it. And then I've been 2 years since the crisis. I went last year in 2011 for about 3 weeks. And this time I've been 9 weeks, just came back about a month ago.
What's your own perception then about the... Is it true to say that there's a difference between what we're getting on the TV here, places like Channel 4 News, BBC News, and what you saw is actually happening on the ground?
Yeah, and the simplest possible answer is yes. The key factor here is exactly how much different it is, and I think people don't really grasp how much misinformation is actually being said about Syria and possibly, you know, elsewhere. I mean, it's very interesting what you've been saying about the whole deception of 9/11, and certainly when I was traveling through Syria, it felt to me like it was a completely different country than was being reported on the BBC and you know, American broadcasters and in our newspapers as well. And it is very slanted towards the rebels. They try to make it out that it's a very black and white, simplistic thing, that it's the government versus the people of Syria. But they don't tell the full story. They make it very, very simplistic. And when they do talk to people in Syria, they tend to talk to those who are very much against the government. They don't tell you that about 70 to 90% of the population like the government, like Assad to some extent. You know, I mean, it's like here. Not everybody likes the prime minister, but not everybody likes the opposition. So, you know, there's various shades of grey throughout any kind of political opinion. And that's the same in Syria as it is here.
Now, Vladimir Putin was talking about Syria this week in one of his occasional long TV interviews that he did. That's the Russian president. So let's have a listen to what he had to say.
I believe that the first thing to do is to stop shipping arms into the war zone, which is still going on. We should stop trying to impose unacceptable solutions on either side, because it is a dead end. That's what we should do. It's that simple.
Well, there's Vladimir Putin putting his point of view. I saw a rebel interviewed in Aleppo, and he said, well, one of the problems we've got is 70% of the people of Aleppo don't support us. And that was out of the mouth of a rebel.
Yeah.
And
I've heard that quote as well. I've had exactly the same quote, the exact same figure said to me from a rebel in Latakia. And he was a Christian, and actually Christian rebels are very, very rare in Syria. So, yeah, I would definitely say that there is a strong support of Assad to some level. When you actually pose the question, do you prefer Assad or do you prefer Western intervention, that figure rises to something like 90-95%.
Well, I think this is, it's very hard for people outside a situation to understand what's happening. And also, it's also hard for the people of Britain to understand that they are being deliberately lied to, because this is a psychological warfare game.
Well,
so they keep saying Assad is bad, everybody hates him. But in actual fact, it's not true. But of course, saying it enough could make it true, because these kind of lies are part of the war game, aren't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, your last question, your last talker invited two questions, and I've got two questions as well. Ask yourself, why is it that the BBC and other broadcasters never broadcast the voice of President Assad? Why do we never actually hear him speak? And I think the reason for that is because we would have to translate what he says, and most of the people, particularly when he talks about Palestine and Israel, most of the people in this country would actually sit and listen to him and say, actually, yeah, you know, I agree with you. But also we would get to hear something of his body language, I see something of his body language, hear something of his tone, and he would come across as somebody who is quite astute, quite intellectual, quite reserved. He's actually quite a very calming man, and that's the aura that he gives out. And the second question is, why do we never Why do we never get interviewed the people of the country? It's always the rebels on one side who are very much against the government. And then when they talk about somebody who is pro-government, it's always somebody from the government. But they never talk to doctors, they never talk to shopkeepers or students or just ordinary people and get their opinion. So there's my two questions. Why do we never hear the voice of the president? Why do they never talk to an ordinary person in Syria who isn't necessarily for or against the government, just an ordinary person getting on with their life?
Okay, Gary, can you tell us finally then whereabouts you're speaking next week and when?
Hamilton Hall, which is on Stokes Road. It starts at...
Hang on. It's Hamilton House on Stokes Croft.
You're not from
Rome? Yes, sorry. I'm from Newcastle, so I don't really know the area. I did have it all written down, but yes, so that's it. Thank you very much for advising me on that. It starts at 7 o'clock, and because I've been to Syria, I've got a lot of exclusive footage that I'm going to be there that you've never seen before, and it should be quite a very interesting story about what is really going on in Syria, and you'll certainly see it from a different point of view than you're seeing from the TV.
Okay, just to remind you, that is next Thursday evening, 7 p.m. at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft. Gary Sullivan, thanks very much for joining us. A rather last minute affair this evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.